Anchored is a production of the Classic Learning Test, based in Annapolis, Maryland, reconnecting knowledge and virtue. Visit us at cltexam.com. Hello, and welcome back to the CLT offices. We're glad you're here. Today, we're joined by Rachel Greb. Rachel is the Director of Secondary Partnerships with CLT. She earned a BA from the Hillsdale College Honors Program and an MA in Christian and Classical Studies from Knox Theological Seminary. She is currently a doctoral student at Harrison Middleton University, specializing in the history of the philosophy of education. Rachel has served as a co-founder and head of school, academic dean, and teacher at Oakdale Academy. If this is your first time listening to us, I'd like to take a little bit of time to explain what Anchored is. This is a podcast where our CEO, Jeremy Tate, engages in conversations with leading thinkers on issues at the intersection of education and culture. We appreciate your feedback, so please rate and review this episode and send any questions or comments to anchored@cltexam.com. Don't forget, our September 14th to 16th CLT8 is open for registration. We've decreased the price of the CLT8, making it more affordable than test competitors like Stanford. The CLT8 is a wonderful diagnostic tool to gauge the academic process of 7th and 8th graders approaching high school. Head to our website, cltexam.com, to register. Now, without any further ado, let's get on with the conversation.
Welcome back to Anchored, the official podcast of the Classic Learning Test. We are starting a new series the first Thursday of the month. We're actually going to have a CLT staff member joining us today, the first one in this series. We have Rachel Greb. Rachel is not only a CLT staff member, director of secondary school partnerships, but she's also a former head of a school and founder of a classical school in Michigan. Rachel, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. It's great to be here.
Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. Super excited. And you have been, a big player in the classical renewal movement for a long time. And we're super thrilled to have had you at CLT now for how long has it been? 2 years, a year and a half?
About a year and a half now.
Well, Rachel, I want to start off, as we have been on the past several episodes, kind of talking about your early education, actually. Did you go to Christian schools, private schools, homeschool? What was education like for you as a young girl?
I actually attended small Lutheran schools for my whole life up through high school. And it was a really neat type of experience. You know, classes were small and it was very intimate and you just knew everybody and it was kind of like a family atmosphere.
Did you love learning as a young girl? Did you have any idea you'd be a future teacher and founder of a school?
So I liked school. My mom was a teacher. And so for us to think about not liking school was sort of, sacrilege. There was just, that just wasn't allowed. But I didn't really ever want to be a teacher. In fact, I remember thinking that was the one thing I didn't want to do. So it was kind of a surprise to me when I started walking into the educational world. I was a decent student, but I had a brother who was an outstanding student. And so I just kind of like happily skipped along in his shadow, a year behind him and didn't really ever think about whether or not I loved school or hated it or whatever. It's just something you did and you went and took care of business and that's what you did.
Well, let's talk about Hillsdale College. I think we have four faculty staff here at CLT that are Hillsdale College graduates. And our very number one in terms of score share. So CLT test takers, they love Hillsdale College, very close relationships. They've been big fans of what we're doing from early on. How did you choose Hillsdale? And then what was it like? You were there in the late 90s, is that right?
Right, yeah, in the mid 90s. And Hillsdale was kind of actually my second choice school. I had planned to go elsewhere. My brother went to Hillsdale a year ahead of me. And so for that reason, I thought, well, I kind of want to, this is my time to break out and do my thing. And I have a great relationship with my brother, but I also felt like it was, something I just wanted to do more independently. But ended up there anyway, after thinking about, my poor parents having to make this drive every for all of the breaks and drop-offs and pickups and packing and unpacking. And frankly, they offered a great financial aid and scholarship package. But it wasn't like for this big philosophical reason that I chose Hillsdale. It was just that kind of what they made the most sense at the time. And I had a great experience there. The faculty has been, is, you know, the kind of the school has been great for many years now, but something that has always stood up as being one of the best parts of Hillsdale has been the faculty, regardless of who's sitting in the administration. The you know, and they've had some great presidents, but the faculty have always been consistently outstanding there.
That's fantastic. And giving me some perspective on how Hillsdale became kind of the firebrand that it is now. I mean, they're down to a 22% acceptance rate. And so many families I talk to say, well, Hillsdale is number one, but we're not sure we're going to get in. And that's fairly new. I mean, it's been a great school for a long time, but in terms of being in a really unique spot and the number one choice for so many, how has Hillsdale kind of transitioned to have this national reputation that it does today?
Well, I think part of that has been under the current president. You know, he's Dr. Arne. He has done a really good job of putting Hillsdale on the national map in terms of the education conversation. Hillsdale has done, you know, really just had the freedom because of their stance on refusing any kind of government funding, which they've always done. They've had the freedom to make their own decisions and people have gravitated towards that. And, you know, it's really become the place that has attracted more and more, you know, children of alumni, like my own kids went there. So you start to see where people have had a great experience and then, you know, their own kids are looking for a similar experience. And so it just kind of has grown over time, but it's been a long haul for them, but they've done a beautiful job of putting themselves out there in the national conversation.
Wow. So on the topic of education, you also did classical and Christian studies, and it seems that that's been an interest for you throughout your education, but also your work life. Can you talk about how studying classical and Christian studies has shaped you as a person?
Sure. So interestingly, I didn't go to Hillsdale intending to study classical or Christian studies. I was hoping to be a biology major, really had aspirations to go to medical school. But what I found was that when it came down to sort of the deadline of having to declare a major at the end of your sophomore year, I really found myself struggling through some of my science classes that were required to continue in that major field. And also just kind of had this internal conversation that with myself that, you know, look, what I'm staying up late at night talking about with my friends is not things like, you know, the Krebs cycle or the sodium calcium pump, right? What I was staying up late in the night having deep conversations with my friends about were things, you know, were the great books and the great ideas and, you know, theology and politics and all of those things. So I went to go see a professor that I gotten pretty close to. And so what do? I need to, you know, I have to turn in this form. And here's where I am. He said, well, did you know we have this major Christian studies and it integrates theology and politics and literature and history. And I thought, well, that's it. That's for me. So it just kind of felt like, yes, I have finally sort of found the right spot for me. And from that point forward, I absolutely loved every minute of every class and couldn't get enough. So is that helpful?
That's great. And tell us about, I guess first, before we even ask this about founding a classical school, how would you, Rachel, define classical? What is it? And why is it so hard for some of the smartest people to define what it even is?
I think one of the reasons why it's so hard to define is because it's not this homogenous idea. And, you know, the whole idea of it is the idea of integration, right? That I'll talk about that, how that relates to education in a moment. But it's a very holistic approach. The classical authors weren't just writing about one specific field or one specific idea. You have authors who are writing about science or mathematics, but they're also writing about poetry and they're writing about the human experience and they're writing about philosophy. So you have these all of these big ideas that are kind of integrated together. And unfortunately, I think part of our problem with our modern mindset is that we'd like to see everything kind of compartmentalized and neatly packaged. And you know, we don't like our food mixing on our plate when it comes to ideas. And that's really not how things were thought of it. And I think our modern education has compartmentalized and segmented these things to the degree that we don't longer see those connections. So for us to try to define what it is, you have to strip back a lot of layers of our modern understanding of how these things are integrated.
So instead of defining what it is, though, is it easier to define or to state kind of the goal? I mean, is the goal of education in a classical framework what makes it unique, being the cultivation of virtue of the human person, freedom from our lower baser desires and appetites? To me, I never heard language like that or kind of a description like that either as a secondary education major at LSU or 10 years in a public school arena. When you think about the basic purpose for education, is that where classical makes it the strongest kind of value prop?
I think it really does. I think, you know, the idea that that our value as a human being is much more about the formation of our souls. And that gives us kind of, you know, there's always this struggle that humans have, and that is the struggle between the living kind of both in an internal world and in a temporal world at the same time. And it's this part of us inside of us that wants to strive for the eternal and feels at home there, but yet we're stuck in this kind of temporal space. And in our culture so much wants to define us by who we are right in this moment and what can we contribute to society and the stuff that we accumulate. But all that stuff that we accumulate only satisfies that temporal part of us, and that eternal part of us is always longing for something else. So I think that was, you know, one of the ideas of classical education is let's kind of turn that around a little bit. Let's really focus on the formation of the human being as a whole, because that is what will bring true joy and happiness, as Aristotle puts it.
So you're currently working on obtaining your doctorate of education in history and philosophy of ed. Can you talk about how that's kind of given you a bigger picture of how education has changed from the past, or why it has changed?
Sure. So I think there's a lot of ways to go about this answer, because the history of education is very rich and it's very interesting. And you know, again, I think modern American culture, we tend to think that the Department of Education that was founded, you know, in the 1970s is really what started the conversation on education. And that's simply not true. This conversation has been going on for thousands of years, and many of the greatest minds of the past several thousand years have contributed to this conversation. But, you know, we could talk about the different disciplines and how they're presented or what's included in curriculum and the approach to learning. But if I had to give one overarching idea that sort of pulls it all together, I would say that the main difference today from education that students receive now as opposed to prior to the 20th century would be, what is our standard of truth? And up until the early 20th century, the general thought was, and regardless of whether this is a person that came from a Christian or a Jewish background or an atheist background, there was this idea that truth was something that stood outside of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it informed us about our own character and informed us about, you know, justice and decisions that we made and what it meant to be human. And the idea of experience of the student now being what informs the student of truth. Mm-hmm. You know, what's true for the student is now that litmus test or that filter by which the student decides what is true, which then makes the student just, you know, think about what is good and, you know, what's the right decision for that person. So I think that that's probably a really big idea of what's different, but that really impacts all of our ideas about how we do education and what kinds of books we put in front of our kids and their experience in the classroom.
Love that. Well, let's talk about CLT for a bit. I've actually gotten feedback a couple of times now that we actually don't talk about CLT a whole lot in the Anchor podcast. So I feel like now we've got the green light to talk about CLT. So I got to say that just by kind of way of introduction and story, when we made an offer to have you come on here full time, you also had a couple other offers, including really the top classical Christian school in the country was going after you. And I thought, man, there's no way we're going to win out over that school. I won't mention the name, but we did. You picked CLT and we were thrilled. What was it that drew you to CLT and the mission here?
Well, I love the mission of CLT. It's reconnecting knowledge and virtue. And that's just, it's a timeless mission. It's a noble mission. And it's lofty. It's a very difficult thing to do. And there's always been this part of me that loves to do the difficult things, that when somebody says, no, that's not possible, you can't do that. Like, you can't start a school in 3 months. Okay, sure, we can. And we did it. So, and these are one of the, you know, I love that about CLT. It kind of has that David and Goliath sort of mentality. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see some more educators really kind of take that view. And it's wonderful to see the classical renewal movement really just saying, well, that's not something you can do, because, you know, the expectations are you have to have students that can graduate and, you know, be prepared for 20th century, you know, global bloody blah, whatever they're saying, but say, no, there is actually something meaningful that we can do. We're going to go ahead and do it. So, and I love how CLT is kind of taking that idea to the next level and providing something that is going to be and is both useful and beautiful for schools that are committed to that renewal.
I love that. We've talked about this, you know, several times before, but when you think about the role, the power that College Board has over so many private schools, you know, when, how do these private schools market themselves and compete? It's PSAT scores, AP course offerings, AP average scores, average SAT scores. And what ends up happening is that College Board ends up having this tremendously powerful impact on the school. Did you experience that all as a founder of a school and just other heads of schools you've connected with, this influence of the College Board that is so disconnected from the mission of a great classical Christian school?
Yes, and partly because when we founded Oakdale Academy back in 2011, CLT didn't exist yet. So, you know, as a young institution, you are really trying to legitimize yourself to the wider community. Because if you just say, well, we're just a private school, we, you know, in a big metropolitan area where I live, that you're kind of just white noise with all the other private schools. So how are you going to distinguish yourself? And so you are sort of chasing those things that people will recognize, you know, college acceptances and scholarships and, you know, National Merit Scholar. You find yourself chasing that kind of stuff. And what you realize is that at some point you're just keeping up with the public school Joneses, and that's not really missional. Yeah. And so when CLT came along and was able to present a completely different way of doing testing and a different purpose for it, it was really, you know, kind of affirming to what we were doing, but also meaningful and something we could now say, you know what, we can say goodbye to College Board, because we don't need them. And we never needed them in the first place, because what we were doing in the classroom was already excellent. We didn't need something like College Board that didn't, you know, even though we existed for one thing, but also just didn't have an alignment with us missionally to validate what we were doing.
What do you see, you know, when you think about the future? I mean, there's just crazy disruption happening K-12 right now, you know, the college level as well. We've asked a number of our college guests recently about this overall just downturn in the humanities, had some really interesting insight there about maybe that being connected with the cost of college and people wanting to get kind of an ROI. And are you optimistic, Rachel, that there will be a revival? I mean, there's already a revival in K-12 in terms of classical education and the humanities and classical literature and the things that you love the most. Are you optimistic that this will impact colleges and universities as well?
I think so. I think, you know, interestingly, what colleges and universities still need actual human beings to fill their seats. And they're out to find the best students. And the best students ultimately are going to be those who think at a deeply and well about things. And there is going to be, I think, kind of this continued divergence of students that are sort of almost in this automaton mode of how to take a test and how to score well and how to, you know, tick a bunch of boxes. But when it comes down to what kinds of a student do we really want in our college, we don't want a student that just knows how to take a test well. We really want a student, I would think, as a college or university, I would think that they would want those who could think deeply and well and really, you know, embody what it means to be human in whatever area of study they go into.
Earlier in the podcast, you talked about how Christian studies weren't your, you know, first choice, or that you didn't know that you wanted to do it until later. I was actually in the same position. I went into like biological sciences, and then I was like, I really don't like this. I don't know why I'm here. What advice do you have for students who are struggling to make decisions about their higher education, whether that's, you know, what college do I go to, or what field of major, or, you know, what field do I major in?
Yeah, and it's funny that you had a similar experience, because my husband was a biology major. He absolutely thrived in the sciences, and that's the field that he's in now. And he was also a Hillsdale graduate. But that is a great question. And I do get asked by students, what do I do, Mrs. Greb? You know, I'm thinking about all these different options. And fortunately, most of the students that I have the pleasure of teaching have a lot of wonderful options in front of them. But I would say to them, and then what I have said to them, is to think really carefully about the institution's mission, mm-hmm. and whether that place in particular is a good fit culturally for that student, because, you know, there's kind of a feel to every college or university. So there needs to be a good fit culturally, mm-hmm. but also regardless of what area, a major area of study, and I've had students that have gone on to medical school, have gone in to serve in the military, who have gone on to, you know, get married and have children and be stay-at-home moms. I've had students, you know, kind of go into welding and business and all kinds of fields. But for them, you know, what I've also told them is, in other words, I don't expect my students to, you know, pursue studying ancient literature just because that's what I love. Mm-hmm. They go on to do all kinds of wonderful things, but ultimately what I tell them is your education is your responsibility, and it's really only going to be as good as you make it, regardless of whatever field that is. So if you're pursuing the humanities, which of course is what I would love for them all to do, but they can't all do that, nor should they. They need to make sure that they don't neglect other areas of disciplines, other studies. They need to take some of those science courses, learn as much as they can about the world around them. And same thing for my students that are going to pursue things like sciences, take a course in history. In fact, history and science are so interestingly intertwined. Mm. And those two areas should be, you know, thought of carefully together. They should take a politics course. They should read some Shakespeare. And beyond that, you know, I think one of the other things that I've told my students over the years is, remember that your education doesn't stop when that paper gets put in your hands at the end mm-hmm. of 4 years, or however long it takes you, or whatever it is you end up doing. Your education must continue for the rest of your life, and only you can do that. You need to continue to read, pursue, and to think about great ideas for the rest of your life. And that's really what I would love to see any of my kids do, is to continue to pursue great ideas and great books for the duration of their life.
And they are certainly doing that. We're blessed to have one of your kiddos, Maddie, at CLT as well. And great work, Mom. She's amazing.
Thanks.
So I want to turn our last question into a little game, because I think I might know what you're going to say. So we always in the Anchor podcast talking about books and your favorite book and the book that's been most formative on you. But I'm gonna do a little 1, 2, 3 with my hands. We're gonna guess. I'm gonna guess, and then you're gonna say it, and we'll see if we say the same things. I think I might know, but I don't know. All right. So here we go.
Hold on, Jeremy. Do I have to say one? I can only say one at this point, right?
Yes, just one.
Okay.
Right, here we go. So 1, 2, 3.
The Odyssey.
Yes, got it. Nailed it. All right. So tell us about The Odyssey. Why is The Odyssey your favorite book? Because, and I think you've read it like 20 times or something ridiculous, right?
Something like that, yeah. Right.
So tell us about The Odyssey. And I just read it this year, and not even the real thing, like the kids' version, which is still, but we read it a couple of times. So tell us about it. Why has it impacted you so much?
Sure. So I love talking about The Odyssey. When I read it for the first time in my freshman English class at Hillsdale, which was this required class, you know, and part of the reason why I love it so much is because it really, as we were reading this great work, something in me felt like it woke up and came alive. And it was almost like you've been drowning for your whole life. And you finally get to breathe for the first time. And it just started, you know, bringing to mind all of these thoughts and ideas that, and questions, about what it meant to be human that I had never considered, but somehow deeply knew mm-hmm. that they were questions that needed to be discussed and that were important to know and understand. So of course the story aspect is just fun and interesting, and you never know what Odysseus is going to do or what he's going to say for that matter, because that's really kind of where his fame comes from, is just how he's able to say, persuade people to basically get them to do whatever he wants them to do. But I loved it because it was just so enduring, how he, not only, goes through all these crazy experiences, but it enduring in the sense that, he loves his wife and he wants to come home. And that's something that just resonated with me, that this is amazing. This is a story that's, thousands of years old, and yet it's so true. We all want to come home. Yeah. And it's just beautiful in that way, that I mean, it's just been, he gives the experience that I think so many of us have.
Yeah. And I can't think of a more important book, and I'm thinking about young men in particular that are just being fed so many bad ideas by the culture, mm-hmm. And you can read this great adventure, 2000 years old, where he's got clarity about what he really wants when kind of he's been had all the other options. Well, Rachel, this has been a joy. We love having you here at CLT, and wish the very best to you and your family.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you today. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Anchored. If you enjoyed it, be sure to subscribe and share it with your friends and colleagues. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.